making paper.
Welcome to episode 121 of Paper Talk, a series of podcast interviews featuring artists and professionals who are working in the fields of hand paper making and paper art. I'm Helen Hebert, and I run Helen Hebert Studio, a hand paper making studio in Colorado's Rocky Mountains, where I create artist books and installations. I also host the annual Red Cliff Paper Retreat and paper making masterclasses here in the studio, and I run a membership program called The Paper Year and teach online classes about paper, light, and books too. Find out more at HelenHebertStudio.com. You can also find the show notes for this episode at HelenHebertStudio.com/podcast. Today, I'm talking with Goran Konjevod, who grew up in Croatia, where he studied mathematics and computer science. After completing his graduate studies at Carnegie Mellon, he worked as a professor of computer science at Arizona State University from 2000 to 2010, and then he moved to California and is now based in Livermore. He started designing origami sculptures in 2005 after having folded from books for a long time. He has been trying to develop new approaches to paper folding and other sheet materials using mostly very simple folds, but lots of them. Konjevod's pieces rely not only on geometry, but also on the mechanical properties of paper, with the pleats generating tension and curving the paper into three-dimensional forms. Enjoy our conversation. Well, Goran Konjevod, welcome to Paper Talk.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here.
Yeah. I've been following you for several years on Instagram. Listeners, he's got a wonderful Instagram at Foldsome, and you're definitely going to want to go check out his work. So, Goran, tell me a little bit about how you got into paper, where you grew up, anything in childhood that maybe was related to folding. And I know you have a whole career separate from folding, so let's kind of lay that out.
Right. So I grew up in Croatia and went to school there and finished my undergraduate degree in mathematics and computer science. But at some point, I visited an event or attended a celebration of Japanese culture in Zagreb, which is where I lived at the time, and saw origami that seemed fascinating. Maybe it was the geometry that attracted me to it. I don't know, but there's always been art in my family. My mother is an artist and a book designer and graphic designer, and there were others. But I just started trying to figure out how to reproduce some of the things I had seen. What I remember are some butterflies, and I remember a lot of modular geometric pieces where you fold a simple shape and repeat, make many of them and then assemble them into cubes and other polyhedra.
Right.
So that was something that I spent a little bit of time on. And then I tried looking for books with more. And that wasn't necessarily easy, but I came across some good ones. And
yeah. So what was this, the 80s, 90s? What time frame?
This was 90s.
90s. Okay.
Yeah. Early 90s.
Right. Yeah. So you do a unique style of folding. Mm-hmm. So how did you get into that? And tell me a little bit about that.
Right. So there were books from which I learned to fold your standard origami pieces, mm-hmm. Some traditional and then more modern animals, flowers, birds, geometric objects. And they were fun to explore, and some of them were quite challenging. They've gotten much more challenging in the intervening years. But at some point, I came across a book by Paul Jackson called Encyclopedia of Origami and Papercraft Techniques. And there was a piece in there that was different from anything else. It was, I think he called it a bulge, and said in the caption something about the piece organically curving after folding a series of pleats alternating in direction. And I thought, well, that describes it pretty much. I can do this. And I tried it, and it looked nothing like it. It curved in the wrong direction. And I thought, well, okay, so he's using some paper that I don't have. This looks different from what I've done. That's probably something in the paper. And I set it aside and went on to fold more stuff from books. And it wasn't until I was in the States. I came for graduate school in 95, and then finished in 2000 and got a job in Arizona as a professor of computer science. And at some point I went back to attending origami conventions. And just around the time of the first one, I thought, well, you know, that thing I tried back then, it didn't work out, but I know why. I'd realized that there was a step missing in his description and in what I tried doing, and figured out how to lock the piece so that it curved the same way as in the photograph. And around the same time, I realized, well, you do this, it's a sequence of alternating pleats, and you can do more sequences at the same time, interleaving them with these two, and you may be able to get every corner to curve the same way. And that gives you a bowl. And then there were other surprising discoveries or rediscoveries, because I'm sure he and his students had done simple versions of these before, where if you start folding from the center of the sheet, pleating from the center instead of from the corners, you get a pyramid. Nothing curves, but it's still a three-dimensional structure. And then combining more and more of these sequences, you get pieces that curve in strange ways and create these forms that to a mathematician look like they shouldn't be possible with paper, because they curve in all directions. They don't seem to even have ruling lines anymore, or they have non-zero Gaussian curvature, which just means it shouldn't be able to do it with a material that doesn't stretch and stays sort of the distant preserved distances like paper does. So that's where it started.
You're going above my head a little bit,
Sorry.
although I'm following pretty well because I know your work. But let me just mention that Paul Jackson has been on this podcast, so listeners, you can go listen to him. And this was one of his early books that you mentioned, and we'll put I'll put a link in the show notes. And yeah, Paul has written many books, and a lot of people know this series kind of that he's done, but this was prior to that. And it's really interesting. I think you probably were just looking through, and this piece caught your eye, right?
That portion of the book was basically a showcase of works he had considered interesting by himself and others. There are other pieces in there that I still haven't reverse engineered completely, that still sort of ping at my brain every once in a while. But yes, it's an interesting book still after all these years to look through.
And then you so you're talking about this pleating, and what do you have a name for it? Pleat tessellation or what?
So I started calling it pleat tessellations, or sometimes I use the words pure land tessellation, because this is terminology from origami, where if you just make folds that cross the sheet from one end to the other, just simple valley folds and mountain folds, John Smith in England used to call that pure land origami, the simplest possible things you can do. No complicated manipulation of paper, nothing that ends in the middle, no folds meeting at an angle, having to form, I don't know, rabbit ears or petal folds or sinks, just simple valley folds and mountain folds. But pleat tessellation seems to be descriptive enough.
And then the mountain and valley, I'm familiar with accordion fold. Are you adding in this pleat where the one folds over the other?
So they're
Your
closer
term.
to so some of sometimes I think I've seen these referred to, especially in books that talk about fabric manipulation and surfaces made by stitching and sewing. Knife pleats is what they call them. They're the alternation of valley and mountain is the same as in an accordion fold, but they are offsets, so they don't all accumulate in a thin strip and fan. They So maybe there's twice as much space between the valley and the mountain as there is between the mountain and the next valley.
Right. Got it. Got it. And then you're often collapsing over. So there's a valley, mountain, valley, and then you fold it over, right?
So the I think the
you lay it down on top of itself.
Right. Yes. They often alternate, and so you make a horizontal pleat, and then crossing it immediately a vertical pleat, and then another horizontal pleat, and another vertical pleat. So you make this progress across the sheet, and when you're done, the result curves in strange and initially weird ways. When you look at it and try to figure out why, it's possible to get a sense of why it's doing this. Where pleats intersect, the one that you folded last locks the previous one in place and prevents it from opening. And so if you arrange these intersections in certain ways, you can get the paper to be locked where you want it to be and flat. And then in between those points, the pleats that run from one point to the other are free to somewhat open up and create this curvature. So it often, when you work with it, it seems like the paper has its own mind and wants to curve in ways that make it interesting afterwards, but also somewhat tricky to work with as you fold. It doesn't want to stay flat.
Right. Yeah, I've got all kinds of questions going through my head. So one of them is your work as a mathematician and computer scientist. How do you feel that goes into the folding that you're doing?
So I've not used it much.
Okay.
I think I feel like I haven't used my mathematical training other than as something that gives me practice in solving problems. So mm-hmm. I think problem solving is the common thread. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I will make a folded thing because I'm trying to answer my own question about whether something is possible, or confirm that it's impossible. More often than not, it's been that I've been convinced that, or even people will say, oh, that you cannot do such a thing by folding. And I start thinking and it's, well, but they're making all these assumptions that may not actually be required. And so you can actually do things that behave in strange ways. But so problem solving, I think, is the common thread.
Yeah.
Either how do I make something that looks like this, or how do I make something that does this particular thing, or how do I predict what this particular process is going to result in? When I've shown things in art, in more sort of standard art contexts, people describe this as process art or process-based art, because there's a sequence of folds I make and I don't necessarily control what happens other than by defining that process.
Right. And that's wonderful. Yeah. And so there's the contradiction of kind of knowing what you're wanting to do or trying to achieve something you have in your head versus seeing what the paper will do.
Mm-hmm.
I make paper by hand, and I do a lot of work where I am embedding wire or string in the paper, and it's a paper that shrinks a lot as it dries. So I have the same kind of experimental practice, I guess, of the more I do, the more I understand what might happen. But there's, yeah, lots of variables.
Right.
So I want to talk about some of the papers you use, because you, you've really explored paper and properties. And so, yeah, tell me about sort of how that began and how it's evolved.
Right. So with, in general, in your more typical origami world, thin and strong mm-hmm. is the only thing that matters for complex designs, because a lot of them are based on ways to try to create long, thin points from corners, edges, and even center portions of the paper, which means you need a lot of layers to collapse into something that looks like a thin I don't know, either a limb or an antenna in case of insects. But you want paper to be able to both stay in one piece as you do these complex manipulations, and let you shape it into lots of skinny narrow appendages. With what I fold, it's not always the case that you need really thin paper. In fact, when I started, most of what I did was folded from elephant hide, which is this machine-made paper from Germany that used to be sold in the U.S. as Whinstone marble, I think, but has been only sporadically available. There are still distributors here, and it's made in only a few colors now. There are people who collect rare old elephant hide in various bright colors. It fades somewhat over the years, but it stays strong, and it both holds a crease and shows a sharp crease when folded, as well as has a lot of attention to try to unfold and help create these curved structures.
Right, and elephant hide, I think, now is available from Talus is the main distributor.
Right, it is. Some of the more specialized origami suppliers also carry it.
Right.
I've most recently ordered it from Talus.
Right, and I think there are two weights. You're using the thinner weight?
I'm using mostly the thinner weight.
Yeah.
I've worked with the heavier weight too, but that requires wet folding. You pretty much need to wet it. And then even the relatively small number of layers I use in my folds is a little too much for that. That's almost a 200 gram paper, and it's very difficult physically to fold. So what I've done with that, with a heavier weight, have mostly been pieces that stay or that end up unfolded. It's got enough structure to stay fairly rigid, even when there's only a single layer of paper there. But the thinner elephant hide is what I normally use.
So yeah, I think some papers have a better memory than others. Mm-hmm. And right now I'm actually, well, I'm not doing it 100%, but Madonna Yoder has the advent of Tess. And I tried folding a few of those. And I really notice the difference in the paper. Mm-hmm. I've used some of my Abaca. The first time I tried, it folded well, but it was a little too thin, so that when I reversed a fold, I couldn't get it right on the same line when reversing. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then recently I tried another one and I had a little thicker sheet, and that worked better. And then in between I tried several Japanese papers. And by the time, you know, you're working the paper back and forth several times, you really give it a workout, and they wouldn't lie flat. As I see her models, they get more puffy quality because of all these
right.
folds. So yeah, I'm sure you've encountered all of these things. So what are some other papers you like?
Right. So I have used some of your Abaca paper. Only a couple of sheets, but I do see how it wouldn't let you cleanly reverse a fold. It's really crispy, and it's ideal for some of the things I fold, because I don't need to reverse anything. I basically just fold.
Right.
Every fold I make stays in that same direction. So that's what makes it a little easier to find the right paper than most of the origami tessellations, where you do need to fold back and forth. But I use all sorts of things. When I went through the first phase of looking for really thin paper, I tried using some really, really thin Gozo and Gampi sheets, as well as Tengujo paper, the almost transparent conservation tissue that is really nice for creating these different layer levels. When you have a single layer, it's almost hard to see. When you have three or four layers, it becomes a gray line, and then you add more folds, and with seven or eight or nine layers, it's almost a white line now. So it's interesting to get certain types of flat folds with it. But I've It's hard to say. There's a feel in a sheet of paper, and I'm starting to get a sense for it, and be able to tell whether it will work or not. Especially some of the handmade or Japanese papers that I buy, I need to add sizing to them, something like methyl cellulose to make them able to hold crisper folds.
Okay, yeah, I wanted to ask about that. So are you just painting that on and saturating the paper with it, or what's your method of?
So I've seen people describe it in different ways. What I've settled on is dampening the sheet and sticking it on the glass shower wall, and then brushing methyl cellulose over that. So
okay.
I think it stays mostly on the exposed side, but the side that's on the glass gets really shiny then, which is sometimes good, sometimes not so good. But the shininess goes away if you handle it a lot also. So it's not, but it does become apparently a crisper sheet in most cases, even thicker papers. I've been able to get a change in how they behave.
Ah, okay. Yeah, I love that. And I mean, your folds are intricate. You're spending quite a bit of time on one fold, so it would make sense that, and I don't know how much time, but maybe you can. I hate it when people ask, how long did that take? So I don't want to, but your description of doing it on the shower wall, the glass, I love that. You know, some artists like want to produce multiple, lots of sheets and would have to figure out how to do it
Right.
production scale. But yeah, just coating one or a few at a time.
Yes, and I know I haven't tried to arrange other surfaces. I've done it on plastic for really large sheets that don't fit on the shower wall. I've done 2 by 1 meter sheets on an acrylic, on a thin sheet of acrylic.
Okay.
But I know traditionally it's been wood as well.
Right. In Japan, they dry paper on wood. And maybe they coat with methyl cellulose.
Right.
I don't know.
Right.
You haven't tried gelatin, which is a traditional European sizing.
I have not. I have not. I have some konnyaku powder, but I haven't tried it yet. Sometimes I plan to do things and it takes me a while to get
Oh,
around
I
to them. So
totally understand that. Yeah, you buy it because you learn about it, and then yeah, you're stuck with your old habits. I totally get that. Yeah, I've used konnyaku, and I've had students who didn't want to get the konnyaku, so they've tried methyl cellulose. I haven't compared them myself though, so I think they have similar properties.
Right.
And then you've also made your own paper. So tell me how that happened.
So I took a class. I went to Awagami Factory for a week-long workshop last January.
And that's in Japan.
That's in Japan on in Tokushima on Shikoku on the smallest of the four islands. And it's a bit of a trek to get there. But the workshop itself was amazing. We started with cutting down trees, and or kozo, they're thin trees.
They're like shrubs, yeah.
Right. And then strip the bark, and then watch them steam the bark. We didn't use that same bark because it takes a while to dry after the steaming, but we also then separated the layers, the black from the green from the white bark, and that was cooked further, and then we beat it surprisingly short amounts of time, actually, compared to the stories I know about Western paper making.
Well, and you cooked it in between. It was
right
cooked.
right and then we had 2 days in which we spent a couple of hours each forming sheets, which was the most interesting part of the experience for me, and that was I realized after some of the instructors explained that it's actually easier to make a thin sheet as far as sheet forming goes with that process, because every time you dip, you can damage what you already have on the frame.
Right.
But then they may be difficult to work with afterwards. But I came home with almost 50 sheets that I've started using and that I'm able to use for my paper folding. So I would love to do more of that at some point, but I'm not foreseeing right now setting up my own vat.
Yeah, papermaking is a huge setup, and there are few and far places in between that you can actually do it yourself. But that's really cool that you went. And did you want to understand the process more, or were you going to make those sheets, or kind of?
No, I wanted to understand the process. I wanted to get a sense for, get a better sense of feeling for a sheet of paper. I have paper that I've bought over the years that I haven't really, that I didn't label immediately. And so I have no idea what's what anymore.
Right.
And I have a sense for which sheets will work for which types of folding just by handling them. But I would like to be able to understand what or how they were made. And so that was one of the motivations. Of course, after 5 days, you're not going to get a lot of that practice. And it's a much longer process and a lot more to learn. But just forming the sheets was also a high point of the trip. And plus, I had ordered paper from them before, and I had heard about the workshop from people who either had attended or knew about it. And so when they opened it up again last winter, I just immediately looked up the exchange rate and decided, okay, this is worth it.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. Yeah, and I'll put a link to Awagami Factory because they do sell internationally. They have lots of papers. And yeah, they have various workshops.
They do,
well.
And they were very open when we were there. They seemed to be ready to tell us everything. The last day we did a brief dip dyeing workshop with their indigo vat. Which is a bonus.
Yeah.
I think.
Oh. And you went, you were one, like, you didn't know who else was going?
No,
just
no.
a workshop participant. Yeah.
Just a participant, yeah. Yes.
That's fantastic. Hey, listeners, let's take a little break here, and I want to tell you about The Paper Year, my annual subscription club. It's kind of like a year-long online class and features a new paper project every month. Get inspired with video and written project instructions designed to spark ideas that keep you creating for the rest of the month. Explore creative paper techniques, including origami, pop-ups, paper weaving, book arts, paper cutting, and more. And join our growing community of paper lovers online to learn and share in a warm, encouraging, supportive, creative community. Visit HelenHebertStudio.com to find out more. Registration will open again April 1st, but you can hold your spot now. Now back to our conversation. I know you've done a little bit with encaustics. Tell me a little bit about that.
So back in when I was in Arizona, I was able to buy paper. I think they called it stone lacta. It was coated with a thin layer of beeswax, and it felt different from other paper I had worked with, and I could fold some things from it that I liked. And when I couldn't find it anywhere else, and coming across some encaustic artists, I started asking questions, and Amanda Jolly, who works with encaustics a lot and who has attended some origami conventions, told me, "Oh, it's easy." And I was like, "Okay, how?" She explained the process, and it's basically a hot plate that you can heat up enough to melt wax or encaustic, and then you put a piece of paper on it, and the paint and the wax will infuse into the paper, or stay on the surface if the paper has coatings that prevent the wax from getting inside, like elephant hide. But with natural fibers, typically you get a quick an easy process. And so then you, I don't know much about color or painting, but I basically work the surface until I it looks like something I can use for folding or has an interesting pattern or design. And
when you say work the surface, are you doing that before you're putting the paper on or after you're pulling the paper out?
On the hot plate. So
on
sometimes
hot.
I'll flip it to work to add more on the other side, or I'll use a brush or a paper towel to spread the pigment, the paint around.
Right, right.
So yeah,
okay.
It's just I've just been figuring out what works without a formal sort of class or education in it.
Yeah. Yeah, I love your experimental approach. And research, kind of. You're doing research through all of this. So I know you do this 50 by 50 show. You've done it several times. I want to hear a little bit about how you work. Like right now, I don't think you're, well, that 50-50 show just happened recently. So
Right.
do you work in, and that's a 50-day, 50 pieces project, which I love this kind of daily practicing. I want to talk about that. But in between that, are you constantly folding? Are you thinking and taking notes, or just sort of a little bit of how you?
I can't stop myself from thinking about it, but I don't constantly fold. I do, especially in the last few years with the intensity of the 50-50 show, I've had sort of slower periods after it.
Yeah.
It's a, so there's a gallery in the Bay Area, that there's, they have studio artists there, but every year they run this fundraiser show they call 50-50. And what it is you send in an application and describe a theme, and then you're juried in or not, as may happen. And usually it's about 50 to 60 artists. Everybody makes 50 pieces. They're all, 6 by 6 or smaller in size. Usually they're mounted on these MDF panels, and they're hung all together in a 7 by 7 grid with an extra piece on the side. So you're asked to make 50 pieces in 50 days, which is quite a fast working pace for most people. And the artists range from photographers to painters to 3D artists. There's a couple of people who've done ceramics or glass, and I don't know how you manage that, but
yeah, I just had Kit Davey on the show. You know her?
I know the name.
She's mentioned that show as well.
Yeah, so I've been sort of having a hard time stopping myself from applying every year, and so I've been in the show a number of times, and I try to every time always have a very open-ended theme. Usually it's centered either about around a new material or a new type of process in working. I've done metal plus paper, which means I've combined a little folded thing from metal and a little folded thing from paper in each piece. Or 1 year I did metal mesh, folding woven mesh, stainless steel, copper or bronze or brass. And then I've done a year where I focused on encaustic. And this last year was the first time I've made specifically 3D pieces and put them on shelves instead of these panels. And these were 50 vessels. So little pots and vases that are a traditional subject for origami, but I used sort of my own ideas and processes instead of the standard forms. So it ends up being sort of a sketchbook that I'm left with at the end, both in terms of some pieces that are actually finished, which didn't sell, and in terms of notes and other ideas. Usually in the beginning I have ideas for maybe half a dozen or a dozen pieces. As the time goes on, I get more and more ideas. Sometimes there's a sort of slump in the middle where I'm not sure what to do next, or things don't work out because I've gone on to try out experiments that are just too out there and they don't make sense. But towards the end, I'm the last few, I usually have to select from a really long list of, okay, I really want to do this, and I really want to do this, and there's not much more left. So it's very strange how that goes up and down, but it's slightly addictive, maybe even as a thing.
Yeah. Well, I did 100 days of paper weaving years ago, and I just found that I had idea after idea, because the more you do, the more you think, oh, what if I did this? What if I did that? And then now I do it as it's an online course. It's 30 days. And I do it every February with a group. And it's fascinating. So I'm curious whether this 50 by 50 project through the gallery, is there any group aspect of it? I know you post on Instagram as you're doing it every day.
They set up a Facebook group, which I don't tend to participate in very much. They've had some trouble with their Instagram, so they're not officially there, but other artists in the show will sometimes also post more or less regularly. I try to post everything as I make it for that show, at least. But there's a meeting partway through where we get together and talk about how we're getting along with our own work.
So do they set a date when you start? Because it culminates in an exhibition.
Yes.
So there's an official start date.
There's an official start date, and 50 days later, there's an official end date. But there's another few weeks after in which you sort of have time to make up if you slipped. And there's weeks before where you know when it starts and you've picked up your panels already. And so there's, you can shift the time somewhat.
And it culminates in an exhibition, and then the pieces are all for sale. I bought one of the pieces this year. I love it.
Thank you.
And I don't know if you remember, but it's an interesting paper with some lines already in it. What paper? Do you remember that paper?
I do. I remember that paper, and I have more of it at home. It's something I bought in Vancouver in your regular art store. And I think I've tracked down what it was called, but I don't know exactly who makes it. It's a machine-made paper with a sort of a lace-type structure, with maybe two different grids interacting. And so there's interest there already, but when you fold it and have these pleats going across, then there's extra layers and transparency that shows up. So it can get busy, but it's an interesting surface to work with.
Yeah, I know you have photos of all of those pieces, and you've got all your 50 by 50 shows documented on your website. I'll put a link to that, but maybe we can include a photo of that particular piece since we mentioned it.
Sure. Yes. Yeah. I'd be happy. I'll send it along, or you point you to it.
Okay. And so that, what month or when was that most recent?
So that's usually the show is usually in roughly in September. Work takes place from either late June or early July through August.
Okay. Yeah. So fairly recent. So, what are you working on now? Where is your mind going after that
So one of the things that came out of working on last year's 50-50 show is this new way of folding certain types of patterns. For a while I've been interested in trying to understand how to make the folding in a sense freer. There are all these geometric constraints that guide the paper as it folds, and it's difficult to make it behave in ways that don't make it clear immediately that you cannot stretch the sheet, and that all the paper you have when you fold it over has to stay somewhere in that place. So curves in particular are difficult. And I've realized at some point last year during the 50-50 process, when I was making these pieces from pleats that twist, and that where you fold like a single pleat that is laid down in one direction on one end, but in a different direction on the other end. In the middle, it goes sort of up in the air and twists. Something about that made me start trying to fold just a series of knife blades and then a curve across them. And it seems to open up new ways to almost draw on a flat surface of paper by folding these curves. So I had some pieces last year that used that. The circle with a square inside was the one that most people seem to like very much. And it's just a perfect circle folded as a ridge lifting out of a flat sheet of paper. But other curves are possible, and I've been playing with ways to add more to it to try to actually draw using those curves. So I've made some I've used that technique for a lot of the vessels in this year's 50-50, but I've also made a couple of larger pieces from this paper, from this handmade and hand dyed with indigo paper that also comes from Awagami. These large, relatively heavy, probably 80 gram Kozo sheets that I pleated and then folded these curves across them. And I realized in the process of doing this that the pleats don't have to be very neat. You can use any kind of irregular pleating. You can even crumple the paper linearly. And then, because the crumples all go roughly in the same direction, you can still form curves over them. It's difficult to explain without showing the images.
Listeners, you really have to go look at your some of your recent posts are showing these, and these are more like wall pieces.
Right.
What size do they end up?
So these three blue ones, which I haven't posted clean photos of them on Instagram yet, but I will soon, are roughly. So the paper was 60 by 90 centimeters, and it stays almost 60 wide, but the 90 direction shrinks to maybe 45 or so. So they're a little over, maybe 22, 23 inch wide pieces and almost 20 tall.
Okay. Yeah. And are you somehow setting the curves, or do you do them as you go?
I score them from the backside,
okay.
And then that score helps form the curve. So the mountain fold that you see, the ridge of the curve, is scored from the back.
Okay.
But again, because it's because of the paper, with something that has a machine made surface and coating, you would actually be scoring. With Kozo, it's more like you're embossing that curve gently. It's not going to actually break fibers or the surface itself. But yeah, that mountain fold is formed from the back, and then the valley folds are just pressed down into place.
Right.
And I'm not setting the final shapes at this point yet. There might be something that I need to do to either mount them to keep them exactly the same shape. Some of the pieces will evolve over time as paper unfolds slightly.
Yeah, I see. So if you move it or ship it, you have to take care to keep it kind of as it has become. I see what you're saying. Yeah. Fascinating. And I know you've mentioned a couple of times the origami world, the conferences and things like that. Just give me an overview of what you participate in and maybe what exists out there in terms of people gathering and discussing.
Right. So there are a number of conventions, both in the US and across the world. There are a lot of them. You probably couldn't physically attend every one, even of the larger ones across the world. The community has paradoxically gotten somewhat stronger and more cohesive during the pandemic, because we started doing Zoom meetings and conferences. And so suddenly we're able to attend meetings with people from everywhere without having to plan or pay for travel. But there are the conventions are back in person. Just last month, we had a big origami convention here in San Francisco, the West Coast or the Pacific Coast Origami Conference, Peacock. And I try to attend either the annual big convention in New York or one of the smaller ones every year.
Mm-hmm.
And when I do, I try to teach something more recent from my works. The conventions end up being classes that you can take where you can learn to fold, a big room where you can hang out with others and just talk and practice, and maybe another event or two. Maybe sometimes there's a lecture, usually there's a dinner, sometimes there's an excursion. I've attended also the Origami Science and Math and Engineering, OSME is Origami Science, Math and Education Conference, which happens sort of sporadically. The last one was in 2018 in Oxford. The next one is next summer in Australia.
Mm-hmm.
So that's geared more towards engineers and mathematicians and has more of a your standard scientific conference format where you submit abstracts and papers and then give brief presentations on the papers. And there's also proceedings.
And do you find that, so you said you've attended those?
Mm-hmm.
I know there's a lot of origami and technology and space.
Mm-hmm.
And do you find that, are there artists? Because you're doing origami as art, I think.
Right.
Versus.
And there's a very interesting mix. It's been it's been skewing more heavily towards the engineering side of it recently,
mm-hmm.
but I've submitted a paper on sort of the mathematical problems behind this this curve over pleat folding, so that I would have a justification for myself personally to go there if it gets accepted. But there are and I use it as sort of an art outlet for myself, but there are interesting geometric and mathematical questions underneath it. And so it's sort of where my math background and the art thing I'm trying to do intersect, one of the few occasions
yeah.
where they do.
Right. Are there, I'm just wondering if there are particular people now that you're like contemporaries and thinking in similar ways, or do you feel like you kind of a standalone in that world?
Well, I don't want to say
Yeah,
I'm
okay.
thinking anything unique, but so there are some people I follow and enjoy seeing their progress step by step as they go. Of the more traditional origami sort of designing a model types, David Gache-Papier, an artist from Belgium, he has a book also of that describes in detail how to make about 10 of his designs. He's covered an extremely broad range of techniques and themes, both in what his folds represent and how he approaches the design. There are a lot of people who do very technical origami design that relies purely on the geometry of the folds and on figuring out mathematically how to construct these complicated stick figure structures that let them then be shaped into their desired subjects, insects or animals.
Right. And what's the diagramming called? Because you mentioned to me that you don't do that.
So there's also the diagram. People will describe their designs using diagrams step by step from the beginning. And there's a standard set of notations and symbols for the diagramming. What I fold is, it would be really tedious to try to follow, because all of the steps would be just make a pleat here, make a pleat here, and so on. So I have some I have a different way of describing them to myself, and I'm trying to make that a little more readable and maybe put together something. I've had an outline of a book for more than 10 years now, but it's only been recently that I've started sort of filling it out more seriously. So maybe sometime in the future there'll be something to point people to and say, here, go read that.
Right.
I've been bad about actually documenting in publishable form, other than putting out photographs of my work.
Oh, you do a great job. And yeah, I mean, as we're talking, I'm realizing how little I know. Like, there's language, and the origami field has been very good at setting standards. I'm trying to write this book about paper weaving right now, and I'm realizing it's like, oh my gosh, there's not a lot out there, and it's not the same as weaving cloth, you know.
Right.
There's certain things you don't even know. Do I have the authority to like just call it this? Or
So there's actually, when you say weaving, there's a thing that's been that I've been sort of trying to do a little bit of, but have had other things come up and take precedence, has been sort of simulating weaving patterns by folding. When you fold pleats, you can there's a pleat, there's a pair of pleats crossing, and one of them was folded before the other, and so you can think of that as one direction of this of
the
this
warp and the weft.
Right, one of them being above the other, and the thing is, with a field of pleats going in both directions, you can rearrange them after the folding in any way you like. So you can get any kind of over under pattern that you want. Some of these patterns do behave a little bit like cloth, woven in similar ways. But again, I don't have enough experience with weaving and handling the different fabrics to be able to say that. But without cutting, you can simulate the weaving patterns by folding pleats. That's probably out of scope of what you're.
Well, no, I think we should meet sometime because I have a papermaking studio. You're doing this interesting folding, and then the one thing that I do with the weaving is I'm just overlapping paper.
Right.
But I am cutting windows so that you can see what's underneath.
Okay.
Because a long time ago, I wanted to make light come through a weaving. And I realized when I illuminated it, oh, it's the same paper on the front and the back. Nothing's really happening. But when you cut this window, you can get light coming through. So
okay.
Anyways, we've got a lot to talk about. But let's go to some of your recommendations. So you just mentioned, so I'll put it in the show notes if anybody needs to.
Sure.
David Gosch-Papier.
Yeah.
And so his book is Shaping Paper. Is
yes.
Right?
Yes.
And you mentioned that it has how to fold some of his designs.
It also has a very generous collection of notes about his process, both in terms of thinking about folding and creating, and in terms of treating the paper before and after folding. So paint or any other surface treatments.
Oh, fantastic.
An exhibition. So yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And then you've got a bunch of books. I'll put them in the show notes, but some I just want to touch on some that I've never heard of. So Joan Salas, Folded Beauty. So that's napkin folding.
Yes, and by napkin folding,
oh gosh, yeah. He's showing me like two lion gargoyles on this. Yeah, it's amazing.
It's a book that shows incredible both geometric and things that I've only associated with origami, but these tessellations and pleated patterns described as napkin folding or cloth folding from the 17th century. And they've tried and reconstructed some of these and had exhibitions in Europe showing the reconstructed pieces in person. There are photographs of those, and there are reproductions from books. It's an incredible historical sort of review of some fairly poorly known precedents for paper folding.
I look forward to looking more at that. And then you mentioned the books by Shuzo Fujimoto.
He's one of the originators of origami tessellations, as they are currently known. And thanks to both the generosity of his family and the hard work of Michal Kosmolski from Poland, thanks to both of those groups of people, his books are now officially in public domain and are available for download as PDFs. They were self-published things from the 70s and 80s and difficult to obtain. There's been a couple of reprints over the years, but still, they're available to anybody now.
Okay, and I'll put the link. Yeah, that's wonderful. Okay, and you mentioned some of your favorite artists. I'm curious about the ones that are not paper folders. So, Ruth Asawa, Paul Klee, what attracts you to them? That kind of.
So Klee has, it's hard to say, but I think it may have to do with process again. A lot of his works seem to be the results of applying certain types of processes to drawing and painting. He has a lot of pieces where there are grids that are strange and interesting and irregular in ways that I thought, well, if only I can fold something like that. Ruth Asawa with the woven wire sculptures, again, there are shapes and structures in there that resonate with what I try to do. Antoine Pevsner is an artist from the first half of the 20th century, worked in France, and he used to build these, among other things, complicated wire sculptures by soldering long pieces of wire that then shift in direction as you move around, and they look like a lot of pleats, but they are built from sticks of bronze or other metal. I find myself spending more time looking at work of non-origami artists somehow, or even non-paper artists. I've been fascinated by the structures I see in bamboo basketry, especially from Japan. Some of their modern artists create these just incredible, not really functional baskets, but forms and shapes and patterns are just.
Yeah, I get that too. And when I'm doing this weaving for 30 days, I have my students go out and look for weaving in the world. Like just the way that the fence, it's not even woven maybe, or maybe it is, but you see patterns everywhere and you can bring them back into and yeah, see how you can weave them. So yeah, I love that. Okay, and you tell me about some tools and supplies. So as I get older, I realize I don't pay attention to my lighting when I'm working. And you just mentioned low angle lighting, and you showed me before. It's just an IKEA lamp,
It's just a lamp with a long,
a neck that you can
movable
move
neck that
around. Yeah.
I've realized recently that I don't know if it's just age or my eyes getting worse, but sometimes it's difficult to see folds that I've
Right.
already made, and I need to be able to find them if I'm going to make the pleats. So I tend to look for spaces and lighting that comes at a low angle. It's much easier to see the, and maybe the direction from which it comes also matters, but sort of flat overhead is the worst for some situations right now. So that, but otherwise I don't use a lot of things in terms of tools. I mean, obviously I need to cut the paper into shape sometimes, so I'll use a ruler and the those snap off Ulfa knives. I've used a wooden folding tool, but more to clean up after the pleating than to form the actual folds. Mm-hmm. I form the folds by using my fingers. I do find that a table with a straight edge along the side where I sit is very useful for forming the pleats.
Yeah.
Or when after I've made the pre-crease, to find it again and start the pleat to find that fold. So it doesn't have to be particularly sharp, but not a lot of bevel on the edge.
Right. Yeah, I've done that. I know what you're saying. And I know you you photograph your pieces and they look great on Instagram. And tell me just a little bit about photographing back with backlighting.
Oh, so backlighting. Well, I have a cheap thing that I bought from American Science Surplus Supply or whatever the name is of the company. They tend to sell these things they probably get at surplus, but it's basically a ceiling tile that has a light that has an LED lamp in it, and so it's flat. It's about 2 feet square, or 2 feet by 2 feet, and it's a pretty strong light that comes out of it. So I just turn that on and put things that need to be backlit on top of it. But otherwise, I just set up a little improvised background with some paper that I already have in the flat file and photograph as needed.
Right. Wonderful. Well, this has been a real treat talking to you. Thank you so much for coming on the show. And remind us where we can find you online. And I'll put those links in the show notes.
Sure. So my website is organicorigami.com. And I don't update it as often as I should, but it does have a lot of the older stuff on it. And I do try to put at least the new 50/50 show. When it comes around, I put all the photographs there, and then I try to update the other information on there. So most of the former exhibitions are somewhat documented there. Things that I'm working on currently may not show up there as soon, as early as on the Instagram, which is, as you mentioned earlier, Foldsome.
Right. Okay, well, it's wonderful learning a little more about your work, and I look forward to seeing what you fold next year in the 50 by 50. I'm guessing you're going to do that again.
I will. I'm still undecided because of this plan to travel to Australia for OSMI, which is right in the middle of that period. So
yes.
Unless I can come up with a theme that will make it easy for me to carry the pieces I make on the trip, it will be difficult, but we'll see. I've done it enough times that maybe I can skip a year.
Yeah. Oh, totally. And I hear you about traveling and doing. I've done that. Yeah, I can take weaving supplies, but it's a whole thing you have to think about. Yeah. Okay. Well, lovely talking to you.
Thank you.
Hey, paper friends. Did you know that I write a weekly blog called The Sunday Paper, featuring stories of people doing exciting, innovative, and beautiful things with paper? Sign up at helenhebertstudio.com/blog. I'm also creating a lot of content over here, and the best way to stay up to date is to join my newsletter list to learn about free tutorials, online classes, workshops, and the annual Redcliffe Paper Retreat, which takes place right here at Helen Hebert Studio. You can find out more at helenhebertstudio.com. This wraps up our episode, and if you enjoyed the show, I'd appreciate it if you could leave a review over on iTunes. This helps others find out about the podcast. Special thanks to Gary A. Hansen for the sound editing and Peter Thomas for the music. Visit helenhebertstudio.com and click on podcast, where you can find out more about these guys, subscribe to this series via iTunes, and listen to other episodes and access all of the archived shows. Talk to you soon.
There's a reason besides the season for making paper.